Hospitalitychain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, Hospitalitychain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace.
First, thanks for just swinging in today. You know, I know you were making an effort to, you were going to be in the area for a customer, and we just happened to make it work that you could hang out in the studio and chat today.
Absolutely.
So it's fun to be able to chat in person, especially with another culinarian. And maybe we'll start there to set the background, Aaron, of, you know, the quick 10,000 foot of how you fell into food, and then we can dig more into it.
Yeah. You know, food has always been a passion, but it wasn't always food. It was more pastry. So like, I mean, people consider food to be food and pastry to be a part of that category, but it's really two separate. So really for me, it kicked off when I was like 16, 17. And, you know, everybody was in that drive of like watching Cake Boss and really wanting to like, you know, figure out how to decorate a cake. And that's what really started the passion and career forth for me. And then, you know, just step after step after step. So going from my test kitchen in my mom and dad's kitchen, I call it, to going to culinary school in Brecksville, Ohio. There's a wonderful place called Cuyahoga Valley Career Center where I went and had the opportunity to study for 2 years and just really learn the ins and outs. And then from there, I continued and I was like, all right, pastry arts is really where I have my passion. And I just went to Hocking College, got my technical degree, went and got my business degree. And then I was like, wait, this like is a sequence of events. Like this really puts things together and in perspective of like, all right, well, and I know how to like do the technical stuff, but there's more to it. So like, let's start exploring this from a staging standpoint to a interviewing and talking with individual chefs and really understanding what it takes to be successful. And now I jump 6 years and it's like, wait a second, I'm not touching a pastry bag anymore.
Yeah.
I'm not touching, a chef's knife, but I am in my own capacity, but I'm not doing it in a professional capacity. It's just very strange to see how you jump through that.
Yeah, 100%. Was it with pastry, the reason you enjoyed it so much, was it the precision of it's got to be this and there's the steps, so that the very technical analytical side?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you can look at it two different ways. You look at food and you can literally mix something in a bowl and it's going to either come out great or it's not. You can, if the flavor isn't there, the visual's always there. You can make it look beautiful no matter what. But with pastry arts and myself, I'm very OCD and analytical. I really want that to look a specific way. I want it to taste a specific way. And it's funny that I say that right now because I never tasted a dang thing in school. I never, like, going through Hocking, I never had the opportunity to taste my stuff. I made a lot of friends because everybody was tasting my stuff, but I never tasted it. I always had my customers be my critiques.
Well, especially in pastries, right? Hot food, as you're going along.
Yeah.
And, okay, let me taste the sauce. And we need more salt. We need more fat. We need more acid. On a pastry, it's, here's a cake batter. You can taste the cake batter, but I don't think you're going to be able to tell, is it a good cake or a bad cake based off the cake batter? You got to wait till the thing cooks.
Well, in theory, you could do the same thing. I mean, look at cookie dough. You taste your cookie dough. You make a small little, it's like a pancake. You know, look at it from a food perspective.
True.
Take a little bit of the cookie dough, you put it in a pan, you fry it up like your pancake, and you taste that cookie. And you know if it's going to be good, if you need to add more salt or if you need to add more sugar, whatever it may be. And it's just like, you could totally do that. But is that going to give you the full effect and the applause in your mind that you're looking for? And for me, it was more satisfying to not taste anything and just give it to somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. That's interesting. I can't do pastries to save my life. I mean, if you give me a recipe, I had a chef in culinary school. He gave us, I call it like a little golden Bible, because it was like all his recipes through his entire career. He worked for like Hyatt Corporation and was in Hawaii. I mean, he did some high-end stuff. And he's like, here's all the recipes that I've developed over the years. And he gave us an entire book, and it was part of the class, like a binder. Still use it today. That's got all of them. Now I have to scale it down because these are massive recipes for batches of like 10 pounds of cookies. And some of them can be a little more difficult to scale down.
Yeah.
Given the volume. But it was really nice to have. So anytime somebody wants something, I just pull open that book because there's always the base recipe. It's like a base cookie recipe, and then you can add whatever you want to it.
Absolutely. And it's so interesting because you don't realize that these skills are things that you should be using on a daily basis. It doesn't matter if you go to culinary school or not. Like when you're in a kitchen, you should be mise en placing. You should be, you know, you making sure you use the claw when you're cutting and wash rinse and sanitize your area. And, you know, the basics that you see on like Food Network, like just for the basic home chef, they don't realize it, but like technically they are considered a chef in their own establishment, in their own kitchen. Like you give them that kind of validation and then they start just rolling with the ideas of it. And it just makes them more passionate and creative when they're talking about it. Cause that's what I love the most is like going to people's house and you could say, well, what do you think about that wine? What do you think about this food? How could you do this differently? And it challenges them. And the next time you're over, their dish is 20,000 times better.
Yeah. And everyone's palate's different.
Yeah. So
very interesting to see how from one person to the next, how different that dish can taste. You know, again, I've got two kids at home and so they're my biggest critique. And so I may find something to be fantastic. And then they obviously try it and they go, Dad, this isn't good, even though I think it is.
Sure.
And then my wife as well, I can tell by her face whether she wants to tell me or not. Because there's times that you're experimenting and even at home, I still add too much salt. I'm salt heavy on the palate.
Absolutely.
And she'll be like, you can just tell by the face. If the initial reaction isn't, oh my gosh, or just that like satisfaction look, you just go, yeah. What's wrong? What about the dish? And you want to fix it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I agree 100%. I think that the biggest thing for me is that I season my dishes or my pastries the way that I would potentially want them to be. And then you give them to somebody and they're like, yeah, this did not work. Or, hey, you need to step up your game and really like investigate your chocolate. Cause I do a lot of chocolate work.
Okay.
And chocolate is something that you can't go wrong with. The only thing that you could, in my opinion, you could go wrong with is white chocolate. I think white chocolate is fake chocolate.
It is fake chocolate. It's sugar and what is white?
I mean, it's literally, it's glucose and this just blob of chocolate. It's made up of components that you should not be eating, basically.
Right. There's no cacao in it.
No, there's no cacao, and it's white, and it's white because of the fact that there is no cocoa in it. And even if there were cocoa, you'd have to bleach it out. You'd have to do something to get it back to the way that it is. But at the same time, it's basically just high fructose corn syrup. It's fake sugar. It's all these things that all these chefs think are so wonderful. But why? And that leads into a question that one may never find out in any day and age. But it's just like there are people that don't like milk chocolate and dark chocolate, but they love white chocolate. And I refuse to make anything with it.
It tastes like fake chocolate. It just tastes like I'm eating sugar. So when I eat, like someone has like a dipped strawberry and it's dipped in white chocolate and then has the drizzle, I'm like, no, like absolutely not. How can you dare do that to that strawberry? Get rid of the white chocolate. I get it. It looks pretty on certain desserts as an accent, maybe.
Yeah.
But as the main component, I'm in your camp. Do you think that with chocolate, since we're talking about it, do you think it's like wine with the different levels of cacao, right? You go from milk chocolate and you keep working your way down.
So it's interesting you say that because I'm a junior sommelier. So I really love wine. I have studied it. I really think that you have to study chocolate like wine. You're spot on. You have to understand the different cacao levels. You have to understand how it's going to affect your palate. You have to understand, you know, in a red wine capacity, you have to let it breathe. In a white wine, you want to chill it to a certain temperature. You know, all of these things go into how it's going to taste in that final bite. And I think that for myself, when it comes to chocolate, I like to go a little bit more on that bittersweet side because when you're baking it out, it's going to take some of that component away. And you don't want to be left with a stale presence, I call it. So I typically go anywhere between 80 and 100%. Just because I know at least 10% is going to be baked out.
I guess over the years, and I've gotten eating more chocolate, I've leaned more towards the heavier percentage. And milk chocolate, it just, it's almost too sweet. It's, again, back to wine.
Yeah.
You start with the sweet wine. Everyone, I don't know many people that just go right out and they're like, ooh, give me some nice dry red.
Sure.
And they're like, this is the most amazing thing I've ever had. I've never seen anyone do that. Maybe I'm completely wrong. But usually they start sweet, then they go semi-sweet, and then they just say this is too much, and then they end up in the dry realm. So, oh man, now we got to talk about wine, because being a junior sommelier, maybe first tell people what a sommelier is.
Yeah.
What it takes to actually become like a real sommelier, not someone who says they like wine and, oh, I'm a real sommelier.
Yeah. So the first time that I really got exposed to wine was working at Cooper's Hawk.
Really?
So I worked at Cooper's Hawk in Cleveland. We opened the location there. I was a wine counter attendant, pouring wine all day long. Had to learn about it. We had our little passports, we called them, and going through every single day and just learning about, you know, a Chenin Blanc Gewürztraminer. What the hell is that?
Yeah, I don't know. What is that?
It's a fantastic wine. It's my new favorite white wine. And it's a wine that they blended. Emily Wines is the master sommelier at Cooper's Hawk.
Okay.
And she is just an inspiration to all of the sommeliers out there. She really has all of these wonderful classes that on, I'm drawing a blank of that, the master class like version that she did, but it was pertaining to sommeliers. Mm. And she'd just go out and she'll take actual customers from Cooper's Hawk and go take them around the world and take them to Italy and take them to Spain and just really teach them about what they're sipping on and how to really have a passion for it. So that really opened my eyes to it. And I loved really just describing what the wines were and the region that the grapes were growing from. And to be a junior sommelier, I mean, it's not that impressive. It really isn't. And I say that because if you look at somebody like Emily Wines, who has studied these amazing grapes and can tell you everything about them, like basically blindfolded, I can't do that. It's just, it's amazing to see that. And a junior sommelier just basically means that you're somebody that has gone through the certifications, that has studied, that has passed your courses, but again, in the scheme of things, it just means that I have passed those courses and right. I studied them and I understand the concept of them. Now, to the average Joe, it's badass. It is so cool. It is so cool. Like all my friends will come over and they'll be like, you're a sommelier. I was like, yeah, kind of. Yeah. What do you want? Like, what can I help you with? And they're like, I want just sweet wines. And it's like, all right, well, because of Cooper's Hawk, I know all of the sweet wines. It's so interesting. And it's also interesting how the brain triggers a concept of wine sweetness. So at Cooper's Hawk, they have something called, they have two different wines. And I'm drawing a blank like a Concord grape wine, but they changed the name of it. One was for women and one was for men because it was too girly to the guys.
Yeah, it sounded the name,
it's the
right.
same wine, basically, and they just rebottled it. And it's interesting because of how it's like food. If you change the name and you change the appearance of it, your brain is going to kind of switch and change that. Mm. And it's just, again, in a wine standpoint, it just is so interesting to see the chemistry of your brain to acknowledging the flavor and the sweetness level. I mean, there's, if you think about dessert wines and you think about the grapes that are frosted over and then they turn it into wine and then they turn it into, you know, they use it for desserts, but it's so sugary, it's syrupy, and people love that. And it's so interesting to your point how somebody's going to ask for like the sweetest wine, but they're never going to move from that scale.
Yeah, I could never stay there. I tried it. It was back in the college days. It was dry a bottle of wine, drink the cheap stuff.
Yeah.
And then as I get a little older, it's like, okay, this is just like, you just tear your stomach. I've tore my stomach apart. Just all that sugar.
Yeah.
You know, there's sugar in drier wines. It's just that natural palate. It's just like, this is too much. Something like beer. There's a great brewery up in Wisconsin, New Glarus, and they grow cherries up there. And so for a very limited period, because cherries only grow in a very small window twice a year, they brew a batch of this cherry beer.
Mm-hmm.
It's phenomenal. It's so good. But it's not one of those you're going to put back six or eight.
Sure.
You're going to have one, maybe two. And it's just in a social setting.
Yeah.
Because it's a sweeter, but it is so damn good. But it's in moderation. It's not, again, it's not
absolutely
going to sit like a nice Oktoberfest where I could probably go a few more on those than I could one of those cherry beers.
Absolutely. And it, you know, it kind of, that is the reason why I got into food, because of the fact that if you know, you sit here and you talk about wine, you talk about, you know, just like the savory side of food, you talk about the sweet side of food. And when you compare all of that together and you put it into one clear package, it brings joy. It brings like a passion of like, all right, well, you know, you look at the show The Bear, and it's based here in Chicago. Yep. And it's a true inspiration of what a day in the life of being a Michelin star chef is. And every chef wants to strive to have Michelin stars. But does every chef want to have that type of pressure and
yeah,
you know, admiration? You can have all of that, but you know, that's what kind of was the turning point for me, was when I was in school and working. When I was at Hocking, I literally for 2 years straight only got 2 hours of sleep. I lived off of a thing of cookie dough and a Dr. Pepper, and that was it. And I just went because I wanted to absorb as much as I could. But then I like really, you know, learned that it's not what I want. And you know, we were just talking about, you know, one of my counterparts from school working for Rationale, and she saw that it's the same thing. You know, it's literally the same thing. You have to find your true ambition and goals of what you want to yes. do and how to turn them into a full career path, because there are so many things in food. Like, again, you could do a food writer. You could be a food podcaster like yourself. You could be a salesperson like myself. I mean, it's so interesting to see how food brings the table together, as one might say.
Yeah. So many times, at least when I was, when I was in school, it felt as if the only paths were go fine dining.
Yep.
Hotels.
Yep.
Catering.
Yeah.
That was really all that was talked about. Nothing else was talked about. And I ended up working in a casino for a while, and I ended up following a chef into contract management. And I talk about it a lot on this show, particularly as I want to show people there are a lot of outlets in the food industry.
Absolutely.
And getting your ass kicked in a kitchen may not be your thing. For a lot, that is their thing. They don't mind it. That it just brings that camaraderie. It's the place of misfits where everyone is out the door and everyone's the same in the kitchen. However, there's going to be a percentage of that that say, I can't do this day in, day out, or
right.
night in, night out. And I love showing all the outlets, the branches of the tree. It's a massive tree. So I got into contract management, and I didn't even know what that meant. Colleges, schools, BNI, mm-hmm. sports and entertainment, parks around the country, the wildlife parks.
Yeah.
All those are usually ran by a contract management company. So you're in those environments, you're just providing food, you know, as a company, because those places don't know what to do with food.
So right.
Bring somebody in. That's the tree that I went into. And even within that tree, there was umpteen things. You can be at the operation level. You can work at the corporate level. There's the culinary teams
yeah.
and there's the purchasing teams.
Yeah.
There's so many places you can go and end up in this industry.
And the thing that my chef instructors taught me was, don't let something scare you the first time you do it. And that has stuck with me for so long, because I did catering in school. I, you know, who knew that I could do chocolate work in school, or I could do pulled sugar, or, you know, the thing that stands alone and sets you apart no matter what industry you're in is how you present yourself mm. and how you know, how you network and how you put yourself out there in the industry. Because again, I didn't know, as a 17-year-old chef, everybody is linked together, and your path that starts at 17 is going to follow you till the day you die. And it's just so interesting to see that, because you look at a finance person, they go, they type their work, they do what they need to do, but their path is going to follow them in their corporation. It's not going to follow them outside of that building.
Right.
In the hospitality industry, you're spot on. You have all of these avenues and all these places, and you're like, oh shit, like all right, I've really got to present myself like I'm a badass and I can do whatever I set my mind to. And that is what has gotten me into what I'm doing right now. And, you know, I just think that that's the biggest lesson for young chefs. You know, you got to just make sure that you're supporting each other one-on-one, and you never know who your boss is going to be. You never know who.
You know how many times I've heard that?
Yeah, yeah. But do you know that, like, it's so true? Because you walk out of school and you start applying for jobs, and literally the next the next email I got after that was, "Hey, how are you? This is Chef So and So. Oh, wait, we worked together at this event." And I'm just like, "Oh, awesome! Like, that's fantastic. I'm so glad that you remember me." But what if it was a negative aspect?
Right.
Like, that's the type of thing that I always, you know, am self-conscious about, because you can go anywhere. You know, the National Restaurant Association has a show every year here in Chicago, and it's the biggest show. It's like the Super Bowl of shows, in my opinion. And
in the United States.
Yes, yes. And it's just so interesting because you're walking the floor and people will literally stop you and be like, "How are you doing, mm-hmm. chef?" And it's like, I'm so happy you remember me, but I don't know who you are. Yeah. Like, I really don't know who you are. And I'm so sorry about that, because I really wish that I did. But you meet so many people, you can't keep a Rolodex.
It's incredibly hard.
Yeah.
Now that I do this and I work with a lot of rep groups around the country, "Hey, Chef Jeff," I'm like, "I'm sorry, I don't know who you are." And they'll explain who they are. And most people are very, it's the hospitality industry.
Absolutely.
They're very forgiving, and they're not, "How dare you not know who I am?" And then I try and remember names. Faces, I'm great. Once I see a face, I usually don't forget the face. Names are where I struggle.
Yeah.
And it's something I've been working on, of the different techniques of saying someone's name after they introduce themselves. And then you use it in a sentence again. And usually if you can say it something like 3 to 5 times in the first, like, 2 minutes you meet somebody, you'll remember their name.
Sure.
If you've linked it to, somehow you've linked it or associated their name,
yeah,
to their face. But you're spot on that even if you have a bad experience in a kitchen or someone is not treating you the way you want to be treated, you still have to, it's very difficult. You have to keep your composure.
Absolutely.
And you have to keep your integrity.
Absolutely.
Because as you said, it will follow you in this industry, and you don't know who you're going to end up touching. It may be a coworker that saw how you acted and said, "You were a dick. I don't like, but, and now I run this. Why would I?" You know, they may not tell you this, but I'm not going to hire you.
Right.
Because of the way you acted when we worked together to the chef that we had, even though he was this way.
Absolutely.
You said this or you said that. So very, very small industry. Let's maybe transition, like, where you're at now. We're going to try and make food safety sound fun. That's why I wanted to start this conversation off, not just with food safety.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of what you're doing now. So let's navigate how you got into food safety and maybe at Testo, and let's start there.
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting how I landed into the realm of food safety, because food safety in the hospitality industry, you're doing that on a daily basis. I mean, you look at ServSafe. That was my first introduction to food safety. And there's obviously different levels of food safety. You have the standardized test of ServSafe, and then you have the alcohol version of ServSafe, which I've done both. And it's very interesting to see how it changes with the regulations. But prior to coming to Testo, I worked at a cookie company in Columbus, Ohio. You may have heard of Cheryl's Cookies before.
Mm-hmm.
And Cheryl Kruger, who owned Cheryl's Cookies back in the day, she started a new company called C. Kruger's Finest Baked Goods. And prior to getting into that industry of cookie sales, obviously as a baker and a chef, I understood it, but I didn't fully understand what goes into it. So it was very interesting to sell cookies, but also learn the production side of it. And I was on LinkedIn one day, and I saw a job for Testo, and I'm just thinking to myself, I'm like, this is very interesting. I've never heard of this organization before. Did some research and understood that they're a German-based company that is in the Black Forest of Germany, and they started as an HVAC company. You know, many moons ago, they started in the sector of HVAC secure sensors and instruments and all of these cool gadgets that HVAC industry professionals probably geek out as much as we do when it comes to, you know, thermometers and those types of things. And I was stoked when I got the opportunity to switch and transition into food safety and just starting to learn what it takes to provide that. Because if you look at the EU and you look at the United States, it's so interesting because Germany and Italy and Great Britain and all these places, they have all of these components that we don't have here in the United States. We don't have regulations when it comes to frying oil. We don't have regulations when it comes to, specific types of temperature control. Mm-hmm. And those are the things that I was like, wait, I've done everything. I can't say that I've done everything in this industry, but this is one thing that I haven't done. So I was really excited about the opportunity to just learn the navigation of, how do I present this to a chef like yourself or a chef in a quick service restaurant, like the customer that I, I'm here seeing this week, they're based in Australia and they have different regulations when it comes to how long they keep food for, how long they temperature, they have it in on the grill for. And it's so interesting because it's not the same as the United States, but they're bringing that EU capacity and regulation over here to the United States. And we're always 5 years behind.
I was going to say, somewhere between 5 and 10.
We're always 5 years behind. But Testo as a company started a food safety sector probably 10-ish years ago. And it's just fascinating. We have the opportunity to work with IT departments. We have the opportunity to work with chefs and quality control, research development. It really is like bringing a full circle into my career path. And it's just been very fascinating to see that. And I'm very excited to see what the food industry does as far as food safety. We don't want to get into politics, obviously, but we have to look at politics in some aspects because our government is how we get our regulations. Mm-hmm. They work with the different organizations around the world to create the United States versions of that. And you have to almost question, when are we going to get up to that full capacity of being able to match the EU? I think it's coming. But I don't think it's going to be for another like 10, 12 years.
I mean, they're trying. I mean, they're pulling food dye out of things. And you see a lot of companies, I think it's end of next year that has to all be pulled out.
Yeah.
Big companies are realizing, might as well make the switch now. Eat it now versus trying to push it to the end. Because you see a lot of announcements by these big companies that are like, you know what? We're going to stop putting that product in the foods here. And we're going to go to the clean level.
And it's interesting because if you go back in history and you look at the food, like M&M's, for example, Hershey's.
Yeah.
If you look at that version in the United Kingdom, they didn't use dye at all. Like the bad dye, I should say. They used all natural from the beginning because they wanted to provide their customers a organic version of what we're getting here in the United States. And if there's one thing that the United States is lacking, it is food safety. It is regulation. It is how do we provide a consumer product where it can be organic but not cost us $25.
Yeah, it's ridiculous on how much those labels, from what I know and understand, you're paying for a label.
Yeah.
There's still so many things that happen. People see organic and they think it's the cleanest thing on earth. It's not the case.
Right.
So you have to be careful that even though something is labeled organic, you think you're getting this amazing thing. They still spray certain chemicals on that organic produce.
Absolutely.
It's not like it's naturally, hey, we planted a bunch of strawberries in a field and however they come up, they're organic. They still have preventative measures because bugs and disease will still, it's just what the level of they have to use and how much per million that they can get away with. I don't mean that in a bad way. It's just they're going to do whatever they can to get away with it and say that it's organic and slap a higher price tag on it because the American consumer in general is dumb. They're not educated enough.
They're not. And it's interesting that you say that, because I was just at a conference probably a month or so ago, and probably longer at this point, and it's called IFT, and it's the Food Scientist Convention. And it was the coolest thing that I've ever been to, because I got to talk to researchers that are researching the different, you know, to your point, the different dyes, the different ways that we can grow food so that way it's better for our bodies. And they're like, wait a second, we've never seen these instruments like your Testo 270 before, or, you know, we've seen a version of of a thermometer, but we haven't seen one with infrared in it before. And that can help us really like determine to like a millionth of a milligram of what we're trying to do. And that's the type of excitement that we need in this industry. We need food safety to be excited again. We need consumers to be excited about learning about what they're putting into their bodies. We need manufacturers to understand that, you know, yeah, they see rep after rep after rep, but we're not that traditional rep. We're here to help you get to that next level, because if you succeed, we succeed. And we're not that typical company that's just going to, you know, brush you to the side. We're going to help you get to that next tier. And that's what makes me excited about being in a role like this, because of the fact that we get to bring the American food safety sector to that next level. Now, is it going to be done overnight? Absolutely not. Right. Is it going to be done over the next 2 years? Probably not. But if you're looking at things like, you know, fried foods are the number one thing in the United States. You have, you know, your chicken nuggets, you have your French fries, you have your mozzarella sticks, so on and so forth. But what if that oil isn't good for you? Like, what if that oil is not, you know, hasn't been changed in 3 months, and you,
oh my God,
you know,
a week, and
yeah,
it's garbage.
Exactly. But like, you know, how do you know that? How do you know when you need to change that?
Don't know.
And how do you educate your staff on it? Because, you know, I'm not saying that I'm old, but I'm not a part of like the new generation that's out there. That's, you know, college students that are, you know, working at these fast food chains that aren't excited about working there. They're like, ah, it's just another job. But we could make it excited for them. They could be like, oh, hey, can I use the Testo 270 today? It excites me about that. Or like, hey, can I use our 104 to like, you know, dissect into like the temperatures as I'm, you know, checking the food. And you got to make it exciting. And that's the one thing that we're lacking within this industry, is the excitement. In whatever department you work in, everybody is so boggled down with the politics of the organization or whatever it may be. You know, I don't think that I saw two people at a store that, or at a customer that I was talking to last week, there were not two people in that room that smiled. That when I asked them, how are you enjoying your job? Like, how can we help you? They just didn't react. They were like robotic.
Wow.
And that's what we're lacking. And that's how I when I talk to my customers, I tell them, I'm like, that's what sets us apart. That's what sets Testo apart, is the fact that we're going to be there to support you. We're going to be there to help you drive that excitement. You know, I've been in that shoe of being a manager. I used to work at a barbecue place, temping, you know, brisket at 4 a.m. You get it. You know, all of those things. And, you know, the one thing that you look at after post-COVID is, how do we make our areas more efficient? How do we reduce the workforce? But you really don't want to reduce the workforce. You really just want to integrate the workforce into
reallocation of the labor.
Exactly.
Take the labor. Everyone thinks that all this technology and these things we're trying to implement are just going to take jobs away. No.
Look at AI.
There isn't enough jobs, period, in the food and beverage industry.
Right.
We need to take the people that we can get, and we need to reallocate the labor into what's important. And if we can put some tools in place that they don't have to go in the walk-in every day and find the hanging thermometer and hope it hasn't been broken or busted, and then write that on a piece of paper with their name, you know, all the steps. And they've got 15 coolers. I'm talking like in higher ed, you got coolers.
Yeah.
You got 15 coolers. Nobody wants to do that.
It's so
it's not enjoyable.
It brings up 2 points. The head honcho of LinkedIn was on the Today Show about 3 days ago, and he was talking about AI and how AI is going to bring anything to the next tier that we want it to be. But people fear that AI is going to take away jobs. That's not what it's going to do. It's only going to help bring, especially in the hospitality industry, in food safety, it's going to allow you to reduce all of that temperature check that you're talking about.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's go back to bread and butter of food safety for a moment. When you're talking about that, you're talking about pulling a clipboard, you're pulling your thermometer out, you're cleaning it off, and you're going and you're doing your temperature checks. What if you didn't have to do that? What if you just had to look online because your sensor is already up and online?
That's what excites me.
You know, how do you bring the industry to the 21st century?
Yeah.
And that's what Testo's here to do, is bring a AI component to your infrastructure. Obviously, you think about, well, you're going to have a sales rep, and that sales rep is going to nag you, and they're going to not take care of you. That's not what's going to happen here at Testo. We're a 4-man team, okay? We're actually more than that. But if you think about it, you have such a small team. We have Tom, who's working with restaurants and chains. We have Jason, who works in distribution. Myself, that is in all categories. We have Leanne, that works in convenience stores. And then we have Steven, who works in our grocery stores. That's 5 people. You know, how do you think that we're not going to nag you, but what we're going to do is we're going to make sure that you're taken care of. Because if there's one thing that I've learned in my time in the industry, you're a family member the second you talk to me, because you want to be taken care of. And I literally said that to my group yesterday. You know, I'm on call for you. If you need something, you have my number. You take care of that by calling me, and we're gonna help you through that process. And that's, again, what's going to set us above and beyond from any other company, because you're going to get that service from us. So enough about the background of Testo. I think you're more excited about talking about the gadgets.
So you brought gadgets. And again, I don't want this to sound like sales pitch, but when people bring cool kitchen gadgets, I want people to see it, because pull that thermometer. So when I see this, okay, I'm like, ooh, ThermoPen. But as Aaron says, no, it's not just that. It's got infrared on it. So now you can do surface temperatures. Come on. Like, to be able to just scan and know that your surface temperature, whatever you need to be, is at a certain temperature. But then, oh, by the way, let me pull out and actually just quick probe. For anyone, I don't know if cooks nowadays, and maybe you've seen it in kitchens, a lot of kitchens don't have thermometers like this or even a ThermoPen. It's still the old school bi-stem.
Yep.
You got to go up 2 inches on the thermometer, and then it's still on like the mercury dial, and it slowly goes up. People don't understand how much time that wastes, how inaccurate those things are. You have to calibrate them all the damn time.
Yep.
Whereas this, it's like, oh, if it needs calibrate, usually there's a calibration button, stick it in ice water, boiling water, and it resets itself.
Precisely.
And goes exactly, and it's exactly where it needs to be.
And the other cool part about this is the fact that it links to our applications.
Exactly.
So, like, literally, you're getting rid of, there's a term that we use, it's called pencil whipping. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
those that don't know, pencil whipping, when the health department comes and you haven't taken temperatures of anything, you literally grab your pen or your pencil and you fill out everything. Chef says, get everything up to date, and cooler log's the best one.
Yeah.
It's the 20th of the month, and the 1st was done, the 5th was done, and the 10th was done, because Mary's there every day and she does an awesome job. And every other day is empty. It's, you write the date real quick, you write the temperature, and usually it's the same temperature. And what's the best is that you can tell, because it's the same pen color. It's the same style handwriting, even though it could be the same person, and the signature. You can just tell. You can tell it was pencil whipped, and you just filled in information.
Or I love this. I was at one of my old jobs. There was somebody that would literally come in, and it would be like October 1st. I would fill in the cooler, and then I would be at a different location, and then I'd come back at the end of the month. And what they did is they just took an arrow, and each day they the arrow. That's pencil whipping in its finest. So it gets rid of that, you know, accountability. It takes out that extra step for your managers. So basically all you have to do is you have to go into an application, you export that file, you print it off for your health department, and now you're done.
Yeah.
And they're going to be like, wait a second, how did you do this so quickly?
Yeah.
They're going to be like, how is this so neat? I can actually read this. And it just, it brings you to that next level. It brings you to that accountability of your health department being like, okay, I don't have to come back here for another 6 months. But before that, I was here every single month. And everybody regret, like, it's just like that grin on their face. They're like, ugh, the health department's here. Now what do I have to do? Like, what do I have to fix?
And if they were also just doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Exactly.
Would it be a dreaded visit? That's what I always did in my kitchens. I ran it as if the president of the company came in.
Yeah.
We're running it like this every day. When the health inspector comes in, we're not scrambling around to be like, oh, no. Get that shit off the floor. Unless a truck just came in. There's some things that you just have to explain. Like, literally, the truck just came here and we had 300 pieces.
Right.
We physically just can't get it on the shelf until, I don't think I ever had any say, well, that's just not acceptable. They're like, we get it.
Sure.
And they can tell that it just came off the truck.
Yeah. I mean, and that brings up a great point is, you know, the thing about the Testo Severus application that we have is you can create a checklist that is basically going to allow you to create a step-by-step guide for your staff members. And if you're checking in a truck and you need the temperature of that chicken and it's not the correct temperature, it's going to be like, wait a second, you need to send this back.
Mm-hmm.
And for those that maybe, you know, are having a bad day or don't recall or just don't care, it's going to hold them accountable. So that way you're not putting bad product into your facility and you're sending it back and getting that credit right away. So that's why I love this thermometer. I use this at home. I mean, the first time I got my hands on this, I was like, wait a second, I'm sous videing a steak. I'm using the infrared to make sure that my sous vide is using like proper temperature.
Right.
It's an amazing device. It is phenomenal. You do a lot of dry aging. So like, you know, you could just use the infrared on this just to, you know, zap through. Obviously, you would need to open the door because of the fact that infrared would bounce off the glass. But it's another great device that you could use for that.
To get, again, that surface temperature.
Yeah.
Again, to me, like receiving, that would be because what do everyone do? They'll take a thermometer. They'll wedge it between two things.
Yep.
You're not getting a good,
good
temperature. And obviously you can't pierce it, you know, like we
right.
milk bladders and things of that. And you still have to check, is it the proper temperature? Because at the end of the day, if food's not kept safe and out of the temperature danger zone, at the end of the day, you will kill someone.
Absolutely.
Or get somebody really sick. And what's the number one way to kill a restaurant? To get somebody sick.
Yeah.
And that's what kind of gets completely forgotten about. Everyone is, again, focused on, oh, we got to get James Beard and awards and Michelin stars. And those places obviously usually do it right, but when you're beginning out, usually you're not there out the gate and you're thinking about how do I get there? You're not even, like food safety is almost like a secondary thought.
Yeah.
And that should be on the forefront of, okay, because if I get one person sick, I could completely destroy this entire establishment.
Exactly. And the thing that scares a lot of people about food safety is the cost.
Yeah.
You have to look at it as an investment into your brand. The cost is the cost in most cases. But what sets us apart is the fact that we want to work with you on your pricing. So let's use a great example here. I got permission from our lovely Mexican chain out here called Guzman Y. Gomez. They started as a company that started with our Testo 270 because they're very invested in their frying oil analytics. How much oil are we using? How often do we need to change it? They didn't have a lot of money in their budget to start with a full solution right away. So they took the baby steps to get where they need to today. And they are ultimately in their new location looking at putting in a full solution pilot to see what the capabilities are. So that's the nice thing about it is that we have the ability to give you a 30 or a 60 day pilot that you can see it for yourself. We want the machines to sell themselves. We don't want to, like, we want to be there to support you.
Right.
But the data is what's going to sell it for you. And that's what really sets a lot of companies apart is the fact that they're not going to give you the opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
So, you know, make it exciting. Bring in a contest. So, like, I tell a lot of people, when you do fry oil analytics, why not turn it into a contest? Like you have 13 locations every week. Look at the store that has the highest, lowest TPM of the week. They get a $50 gift card or they get to go out, you know, during their shift and go do something fun. You know, things like that bring that excitement of wanting to do food safety.
Yeah. Or fryer oil. I want you to pull that little guy out.
Yeah.
I don't want to talk about it. When I was in higher ed, we ended up with, it wasn't this solution, but it was an all-inclusive fryer solution that you use strips instead, or you would actually take a dropper of the oil.
Yeah.
And you would just compare it up to the sample, and you knew, okay, I need to filter it or I need to get rid of it. For those that don't understand, when you usually see like chips, especially at a Mexican restaurant,
yeah,
really, really dark, mm-hmm. it's because the oil's dirty. All that, all the schmutz, as we call it, right?
Yeah.
Everything else that gets cooked inside of there starts to burn. It just continues to burn.
Exactly.
Of that oil. And their particles, most of the time, you can't see. They're not microscopic, but they're so small that you're not going to physically just like looking in a fryer and be like, oh, there's dirty bits and pieces.
You'll sure.
take stuff that folds to the top, and you'll take a spider, which is like a little wire mesh thing that goes in a fryer, and you can skim that out. It's all the stuff that's floating around that you can. And so then when you try those chips, you're just like, oh, they taste like shit.
Yeah. They're
not even like really crunchy at that point.
They're soggy.
Yeah.
They have like that bitter taste. It's just because of, it goes back to the credibility of what is in that oil and how often are you changing it. So it's funny because I go to a lot of places and they have the strips where they dip it in and they check the, you know, the side of the cup and it has the different readings. So like red equals okay, or mm-hmm. or orange is like, eh, all right. And then like yellow kind of, you know, check it out. And or they will filter their oil and then they'll check it and be like, oh, it's fine. But it's really not. Because at the end of the day, you're just cleaning it, you're putting it through that filtration process, but you're reusing it. And a lot of places are going to give you that same chip that you were just talking about. So how do we go forward and, you know, prevent our staff from, you know, burning themselves by dipping this in the, you know, with their long gloves? Testo was very thoughtful and very driven to make sure that, you know, your staff is taken care of when they created this. So this here is a Testo 270. This thing is probably the coolest thing that I've seen in a very long time.
I saw it. I was like, what in the hell is that device?
This thing is so badass. I love selling this because of the fact that it is so educational to an establishment. So, you know, you have your basic probe here, and then you have a microchip here. And this microchip is like the all of all. It basically will tell you the temperature. It's going to tell you the TPM. And a lot of people are like, what the hell is TPM? Are you just talking in another language to me? Or what exactly does this mean? Well, TPM is the total polar material. And it goes back to what you were talking about of what's left in your fryer after you fry and the fatty acids. You don't see those fatty acids. You don't see what's left in there. You don't see any of that stuff. But the Testo 270 does. It literally picks it up. It will see the fact that, you know, a lot of places will use, you know, canola oil. That's the most common oil in the US at this present time. And you just have to turn this on and it's going to start reading right away. Obviously, you want your oil to be up above between like 275, 375. You want to make sure that it's up and running. And what you'll do is you'll run this in the morning before your establishment even, you know, we call this the wake up check. Your establishment is getting, you know, set up for the day. You're going to do your safety checks and then you're going to check the TPM. And what I do is I encourage a lot of people to even test the TPM after they change out the oil. So you take out that oil, you know, discard it, you dump in your new oil. And you should see anywhere from a 0.1 to about a 0.8. That's the range that you should see. Now, if it's higher or lower, that's going to be dependent on the type of oil. It's going to be dependent on, you know, how has that oil been filtrated? Those types of things have to be considered. But ultimately, at the end of the day, that oil is going to be taken care of. And it's going to actually reduce the amount of times that you're changing your oil because of the fact that you have more data in this lovely device.
Yeah, there's no guesswork of it. It looks dark,
but yeah,
actually the oil's fine for whatever reason.
Yeah,
depending on what you're cooking inside of it, it's going to give you that that precise amount of the TPM, right.
And the other thing is like, you look at these new fry companies, I shouldn't say new, you look at these new fryers from the fry companies, and they have something very similar to what the Testo 270 provides. It's a TPM chip that's built into the bays of the fryers, and it provides you the temperature, it provides you that cloud-based service. But is it really providing you that, you know, next data that you need in order to know if you need to change out your oil? In our opinion, and I say that because everybody has their own opinion about food safety and how often you need to change it out, I think that having a handheld device is more accurate because of the fact that you're doing it on a daily basis. You're checking that TPM. You're not checking that TPM on a daily basis when that chip is in there. It's just going to tell you if it's bad, if it's, you know, when it needs to be filtered, those types of things, but it's not holding you accountable. And this device is, and it's providing you more of of that stability and accountability for your staff.
Well, not even that. The newfangled fryers, they're expensive.
They are.
The cost of those things, people don't understand. You could be talking 20, 30, 40,000. Depends on how many banks you've got.
Sure.
How many actual fryer banks you've got. Is it plumbed in? Is it not? Does it have filtration? Does it not?
Absolutely.
They're expensive. I'm sorry. Most restaurants, unless you're a big, big chain, they've got the regular old fryer that's gas.
Yeah.
They've got the pilot light. It's got the tube to paint it out. They're going to need a tool to read. They're not going to drop 50 grand on a fryer.
No.
It's just not going to happen.
Well, and here's the other thing. If you think about the fact that that microchip is sitting in the bottom of that bay, what happens if it gets broken?
Yeah.
How are you going to change it out? If this breaks, you can change this out. You can just buy another probe. You can put it back into this device. It's a savings cost when it comes to holding your oil quality to the highest standard. This is such a robust device that we don't see a lot of returns on this. We don't see a lot of people complaining about, oh, wait, I just dropped whatever it costs for this. Because it's such an amazing way to utilize the data that this device retail is $569. So that's
nothing.
Let's look at that for a second. $569 compared to a $50,000 fryer. If you can save on, I don't know, the average fryer needs about 2 buckets worth of oil from your food distributor in order to fill up.
Yep.
Oil nowadays is anywhere between, I don't know, $30 to $50, maybe $60.
Yeah, depends on the quality.
And you don't have to get, if you go through 2 of those and you were changing out your fryers 5 times a week, now you're saving, you've basically paid for this device in that oil. And it's going to help you just be, understand that traceability. So that's, it's a fascinating device. I swear by this device now. I really think it's going to bring a lot of organizations, a lot of trust within what they're doing, as well as, it's just going to bring, technology's always evolving. It's always getting to a different level. And you kind of have to come with the times. You can't stick with that, in between thermometer. You can't stick with, just that piece of paper that goes into the fryer. You can, but it's not going to be as accurate.
Yeah. Why not take advantage of the technology that in the long run is going to save you more money?
Exactly.
And so people are so nearsighted and they see the price tag of something like, well, I can get by without that. They don't think of the long-term ramifications. Again, one change of oil, a few changes because they think it's bad or they
right.
It's human judgment. I hate to say it. Computers are a lot more accurate than people are. Now, we still need the people. I do think that there's that human element that we need in the restaurants that give it a certain thing. I know there's a lot of robotics coming with things that are trying to cook and do things. But at the end of the day, they're really expensive. And if they break, you need a mechanical engineer to basically fix them.
Well, so I guess let's talk about that for a minute. Robotic cooking. At Columbus Airport where I live, Donato's Pizza just put in a robotic pizza maker. And you have to think about that. Where's the food safety in that? Where are they having the temperature checks? How are they doing, their daily logs? Like, all of that has to go into, like, it's just like having a restaurant. So you think about AI and you think about robotics, but it's still the same thought process as, like, if you were in a kitchen. You have to have all of those things in order to be able to make sure that your food is not going to kill anybody.
Yeah, it's got to be all built in some way, shape, or form in the refrigerators, and there's got to be some sort of sensors. But unless it's probing the food, you don't really, you can only get a surface temperature.
Sure.
Now, pizza, you could probably get away with, you know, a surface temperature, but any, some of the other things, you really have to, you really got to get that internal temp.
I mean, so, you know, this brings up the other device that I brought here. A lot of chefs do a lot of cook to chill. And for those of you that don't know what cook to chill is, it's basically where that you pour your sauce or your stock into a Cambro. A Cambro is basically just a container for you to, you know, hold something in, and you stick a probe in there and you watch it decrease and cool down over a period of time to make sure that it's not getting any growth of bacteria. And we just launched that. We are so excited about the fact that we just launched the Cook to X module. And the ability to track that, so that way you don't have to have somebody set a timer.
Oh, it's a pain in the ass. Jesus, was that a biggest pain in the ass? Because that was the one thing the health department was always on my ass about in high volume, in the higher education space.
Yeah.
Was, I mean, we're cooking soup, right? When you're feeding 5,000 kids a day, you got to make a lot of soup, especially if you got like a weekly soup.
Absolutely.
We'd fill up the kettle and we're making 40, 50 gallons. Or some of the sauces, Alfredo's, things that we're making in-house. You made a lot. And to cool that quantity down, and we didn't have the chill baths, you know,
right.
Wells. We had to put it in Cambros, put ice wands in it.
Yep.
Which, again, say what you will about that. Like, are those Cambros where they, or the ice wands, where are they stored? Are they wrapped or not? The bacteria that's on them. I mean, I'd see them, people set them on the ground. And you're just like, run that through the dish machine before you even, and then it's got to get frozen again.
Right.
So many food safety issues. But we had literally timers set that we'd have to then check. And between shifts, that was the biggest problem.
Right.
So you had a team leaving at 2.
And then you have a, you have to, hey, this is where I left off. This is where I need to come through. And like, this is where you need to pick up.
Yep. And that afternoon team was so worried about what they had to do for dinner. Not worried about, oh, that's great.
Right.
I don't have time to worry about your stuff. I'm trying to get myself set for dinner.
Yeah.
And there would always potentially be these gaps, and we had to make it a priority because that was the number one thing the food health inspector was looking for.
Exactly. And cook to chill is becoming way more common now. Mm-hmm. It is the number one thing out there. If you think about bechamel sauce and mac and cheese, if you think of a college campus, mac and cheese is the number one thing that students seek out. I don't know why, but it is. Ohio State goes through pounds of cheese, and they go through so many things. And they offer like 2,500 different options, but everybody runs to just
mac and cheese. It's comfort food.
It is, but
pasta and sauce.
But you think about that. Break it down real quick. You have your pasta. It's in a bag. It's in a dry storage. You have your bechamel sauce. All the components in your bechamel sauce are sitting in a cooler. Well, is that cooler door staying open? Is it dropping temperature? Yeah. You need a sensor to make sure that, you know, that's being taken care of, because that's a part of your safety there. So, you know, you look at all of those things. So this thing here is a part of our new line. This is a 162T3 here. And this is, it has two modules here at the bottom where you can put in probes. So like, if you wanted to, you know, put this in a refrigerator for ambient temperature, you could use one probe and have the ambient temperature. You can have another probe and you can put it into your Cambro. And it's going to allow you to have those types of data points. But, you know, something like this, where am I putting it? You know, people are like, well, I'm not putting this on my shelf. Well, it has a lovely rack in it. It has a holder that you can literally put directly into the back of your cooler. You can put it, you know, on a rack and, you know, hook it. You can, it doesn't matter where you put it, in the sense of you just don't want it under the compressor.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is because it's going to give you the coldest point of your refrigerator, and you don't want it to be the coldest point. You want to make sure that it's a neutral area. The other cool thing that Testo does is they do mapping of warehouses, where they can tell you the hottest part of your warehouse to your coldest point of the warehouse. Mm. And coming from food distribution, I used to work for a food distributor. That would have been fascinating to understand the concept and science of that. But if you don't have sensors in your cooler, or you don't have a door alarm and you don't have those types of things, your door could be left open all night. And then you're, you know, going back to that mac and cheese, you're making a bechamel sauce with contaminated product.
You know how many times coolers went down on us?
Yeah.
And we ended up, I don't know what the program was. It was sensors that sat inside the cooler, and they were giving us readings. And then if it fell out of range, I literally got an email and it said it's out of, because we, there was times we would lose thousands of dollars worth of product because we,
absolutely,
overnight, and there's nothing you can do. I mean, you look at the food and it's like almost a judgment guess of, you feel it and you're like, okay, well, it's like semi frozen. So like, do we chance it? And then obviously some things that are backed by the compressor are still like frozen.
Sure.
And, or how are they being stored? Right. If they're in a block, right. And there's a bunch of them stacked together, a bunch of boxes, they stay pretty much frozen.
Sure.
But if they were loose bags on the shelves, yeah, or whatever, and they've got the airflow, they could thaw out, and it was like, throw it away.
Well, and that's the other thing is if you look at the type of sensors that individuals are using nowadays, excuse me, you could buy off of Amazon. You can literally buy a sensor off of Amazon. But how good of a quality is that going to give you?
Yeah.
You know, you could buy a thermometer off of Amazon, but how good is the quality?
Right.
It all comes down to how are you, you know, the knowledge of what you're putting into your establishment, getting those alerts, because we do provide alerts. If your door is left open after a specific period of time, you're going to get a text message, you're going to get an email, and it's going to go up the chain. But at the same time, you just have to make sure that you're setting yourself up for success. And when you're building a restaurant, this should be one of the first things that you consider, because the you know, you look at the Well-Built brands, they're phenomenal. I love Well-Built. They have Deerfield. They have all these other awesome types of things, but they don't have sensors built into their product. And you would think that like they would. You would, yeah, think that they would have a sensor that's already built in to provide you those alarms. But nowadays, it goes old school. You leave the door open, it barks at you, basically.
Yeah.
But you have to have these things. So that's kind of like, you know, that's what makes food safety exciting, is the fact that you can take all of this data and you can do so much with it. You don't have to be a financial person to understand it. You don't have to be a doctor to understand it. You can just have the most basic information and understand that you're going to save and you're going to set yourself up for success.
Not even that. It's going to get the health inspector off your back. If anything should excite you, it's when the health inspector comes in and you can hand them a report and they say, oh,
unless I will say, you've seen the health inspector so many times that you've become friends with him and you want him to show up so you can have lunch with him. Because I have had that happen. I've worked at establishments where the health department was there so many times, but then like a new team came in and we made it the way that it needed to be. And he goes, well, can we at least have lunch together? Because like, you know, it makes their day. It really, yeah, does.
Because everybody hates the health inspector.
They do.
Come in, they're like, oh, everyone hates me anyway, so I might as well be an asshole or a bitch and,
exactly,
and get along my day and get through this, like all of them, because there's not many that are a pleasure to work with. I've had the pleasure, not that I had lunch with them, but it was like a way of like, hey, tell me what I'm doing wrong so I can make the establishment better.
Yeah.
And we always did. I know we're coming up on time. So,
yeah.
Couple final things. Where do people go if they want to learn about you? Where do they go if they want to learn about Testo?
Yeah. So for myself, the easiest place is LinkedIn. I do a lot of promotional stuff on LinkedIn for Testo there. If like, as far as like my, you know, to network, they're welcome to go to my Instagram pages. I have a bakery that I do on the side. It's called Twin Delight Bakery. So they're more than welcome to go check out that feed and check out, you know, reach out to me there or on LinkedIn. As far as Testo goes, we have social media everywhere. So if you want to like really learn about Testo in its whole, go to testo.com, or they can reach out on through a ad. We have Facebook ads, Instagram ads, so on and so forth. We're going to be at the National Convenience Store Show coming up here in Chicago the week of the 14th. So stop by if you see us there.
Where's that at?
It's at McCormick Place.
It's at McCormick.
Okay. Yep. So we're going to be there. That's the best way for us to communicate is through Testo. You can request info there and then the lead will come to the associated person. Thank you so much for having me. This has been a blast. And, you know, I very much look forward to seeing your podcast just boom as much as, you know, the industry is absorbing all the info.
Let's hope. One last question.
Yeah.
Going to Italy, I need two wine recommendations. I'm going to be all over. So I'm going to be in Bologna. I'll be in Milan. I'll be in Rome. So I'm kind of hitting all the gambit. So
see,
give me a couple wine recommendations.
Here's the thing. I need to know, what are you going to eat with them?
Oof. Probably. That's a good question. Two chefs getting in a room and then the questions get deep. Probably a lot of pasta.
Okay.
Probably a lot of charcuterie. So give me something. Give me something for charcuterie cheese, you know, when we're snacking on that.
Bordeaux, red or white, can't go wrong.
Okay.
Bordeaux are phenomenal. And I think that a blended Bordeaux would be your cup of tea. And I've never been out of the US. So I have to say that they're coming up with new wines on a daily basis. Mm,
okay.
So I don't know what's in Italy right now. I haven't seen the new charts of what's out there. I can tell you that here in the US, for a charcuterie, I would go a Sauvignon Blanc. I would go a Gewürztraminer for a white. I would go even a rosé for charcuterie. A lot of people don't consider rosé to be a white, or it's more of a hybrid. It's a red and a white because they use the skins of the reds and the grapes of the whites to kind of color it. But I think that for a red, man, just get a table wine.
Okay.
Just get the nicest. I shouldn't say the nicest. Get the cheapest, nastiest bottle that looks like. I say that because those are the best wines. It's like a hole in the wall restaurant. You think, oh, I'm going to die at this place. But then you have some amazing food.
Yeah.
I think that I personally don't drink a lot of red because of the tannins. And it gives me migraines, and I just steer clear of them. But I think go table, all because right. You can't go wrong with it. Now, you need to ask that question to somebody that has lived in Italy that can tell you, hey, this is the new up and coming wine. Or even go to those places where they hold your glass out in those glass windows and see what kind of reds they provide you there, because they won't tell you. They're just going to pour into your glass and you're going to have to either like it or discard it.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Aaron, for taking the time to jump on today. We'll link everything in the show notes as usual to find you. I'll have to check out that bakery. I'm always looking for some sweets. My kids love the sweets. My wife loves the sweets. So thanks again for making the trip
and coming
to the studio to have the conversation today. To make food safety fun, there's either going to be a group of people that really enjoy it, or a group of people that are going to be like, I don't know, but I'm hoping that some see some of this technology and they think, I can make my establishment better than it is today. I can make my food safer, knowing that my customers are going to want to come back, because customers do care about food safety. They do not want to get sick.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I couldn't agree more, but I very much look forward to, connecting with the world.
Awesome. So until next time, we'll catch you on the sunny side. HospitalityChain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, HospitalityChain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace.